While this is loading, I want to thank you for staying for the last presentation of one of the last sessions of the day of the meeting. I'm going to probably change gears a little bit here from working with measuring individuals to switching back to survey data. In particular, I want to talk about false negatives on the BRFSS disability questions and implications for disability services and policy. Unfortunately, I have no financial disclosures to make. By way of a little bit of background, the Behavioral Risk Factor Surveillance System, or BRFSS, is the world's largest telephone-based health survey in the world. It's used to identify emerging health problems, sustaining health disparities, and track the prevalence of conditions throughout the United States and its territories. Within the BRFSS are two questions that are used to screen for whether or not a person has a disability. These focus on activity limitation and equipment use. And using those questions, the BRFSS current estimate of disability in the adult population in the United States is about 20%. A different system out there that tracks disability is the Social Security Disability Programs. These are, the definition for disability within that system is based on the presence of a documented mental or physical health condition. And currently in the United States, for people between the ages of 18 and 64, about 6% are enrolled in a Social Security Disability Program. Generally, Social Security criteria are recognized as being the most stringent because there's money attached to them. We want to screen out as many people as possible and only keep the people with the most severe disabilities. So, theoretically, those 6% of people would be included within the 20% prevalence rate screened by the BRFSS, theoretically. So what we wanted to do is examine the sensitivity and validity of the BRFS disability questions among people with SSA-determined disabilities, Social Security-determined disabilities. That is, people who are recognized as having more severe disabilities that prevent them from engaging in substantial gainful activity. And what we did was we used the two BRFSS disability questions in a male survey with 1,049 adult Kansans with Social Security-determined disabilities. And the sample was drawn from a working age population enrolled in the state's Medicaid buy-in program. And those questions were included as part of a larger survey that we administer each year with that population. We had 391 valid responses to the two BRFS disability questions, which are you limited in any way, in any activities because of a physical, mental, or emotional problem? Do you now have any health problem that requires you to use special equipment, such as a cane, a wheelchair, a special bed, or a special telephone? Just to give you an idea of what the participants in the study looked like, average age was 48 years, roughly half and half male and female, about 50% have at least some college education, and a variety of self-reported primary disabilities, with mental illness being the most frequently reported disability, but also chronic illnesses, physical disabilities, people with intellectual disabilities, sensory disabilities. Other includes people with traumatic brain injury, some dementias, people who self-report as having a learning disability. The results were that 80% of our sample answered yes to one or both of the disability questions. True positives, they have a disability, and the question screened them as having a disability. 20% answered no to both of the BRFSS disability questions. These are false negatives because we know that they're on a Social Security disability program, they have a severe disability. And when we looked at those results a little bit more in depth, we found that people with self-reported mental illnesses or intellectual disabilities were among those most likely to be false negatives, while people with physical disabilities had the lowest rate of false negatives. I know that's probably hard to read, but I'll walk you through it. This is just broken out by disability type. And as you can see, physical disability had a very low 4.8% false negatives. People with intellectual disabilities had 34.1. Some of those columns on the right, LD, ADHD, HIV, AIDS, undisclosed, had higher rates of false negatives, but they're pretty small cell sizes. So overall, about 20%. On the same survey, we asked a series of functional questions. Do you have difficulty with any of the following because of an impairment or health problem? Thinking, remembering, or controlling emotions, seeing, hearing, or communicating, going to school or work, performing personal care activities, performing household activities, moving around. And what we found was that two-thirds of the people who reported a false negative on the BRFSS screen positive using these functional questions. So we were able to use those functional questions to pull out some of the people that the BRFSS questions had missed. On the other hand, if we look only at the functional questions, we had false negatives of about 15%. So I think this shows that you have to have a little bit of both of these kinds of questions. People with documented severe disabilities may answer no to the BRFSS disability questions despite the fact that they self-report having a disability on the same questionnaire and despite the fact that we know they have a disability because they're on a Social Security disability program. And some disability types are relatively more represented among the false negatives, and to me that's one of the most troubling parts of the study, is that people with mental illnesses and people with intellectual disabilities may really be underreported in the BRFSS disability prevalence estimates. And I think that's unfortunate, because I'll be talking in a minute and why that might be a problem. Possible revisions to the BRFSS questions may need to incorporate questions that shift the focus from cause to impact, with an emphasis on function rather than pathology, although I think there's room for both. And I know that CDC is working on this even as we speak. Why is this important? Well, obviously, a lot of researchers use the BRFSS measure of disability to look at health risk behaviors among the disability population. And unfortunately, I think that maybe they're missing important pieces of that disability population by sticking with the BRFSS data. Perhaps more timely and more important at this point is that the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act, which was passed in March of this year, has an entire section devoted to understanding health disparities and collecting data and analyzing that data to look at health disparities. And as most of you probably know, people with disabilities are not always considered a health disparity population when it comes to federal funding. And I think that that's unfortunate, and I think that this piece of the law gives us an opportunity to really address that issue, because the law requires that data on race, ethnicity, sex, primary language, and disability status for applicants, recipients, or participants in any federally funded program or survey be collected. Moreover, the Secretary of Health and Human Services is charged with developing standards for the collection of that data described above, including disability status, within 2 years of passage of the legislation, which gives us until 2012 to get it right. And as you can see at that last section there, E, it requires that any measures of quality for any federally conducted or supported healthcare or public health program, activity, or survey includes measuring or in collecting data on disability status. So again, we need to be very mindful that we are collecting data on people with all kinds of disabilities and not unintentionally excluding certain populations, including people with mental illness or intellectual disabilities, because quality is just as important for those groups as well. And I'm going to leave it there. All I have left now is my citations and my contact information, but I'm happy to answer questions.
Thank you. We got finished in record time, I think. I'm sure you have a bunch of questions. Anybody have questions or comments for the panel? Are you going to do? Okay. Thank you. No questions? Did somebody have their hand up? Oh. Over here on the left. Yes.
So this is for Dr. Philip Gruey, did I pronounce that right? All right. And I guess it's more of a comment. I was just curious about, I wonder how much the ARPSPAN results would change if you took out the people with spina bifida or controlled for them, just because, like myself, for example, I think I'm 5'7" if you measure my wingspan, but don't tell anyone, but below 5 foot every other way. And so I was just, you know, wondering how much it would change.
That is an excellent point, and it's something that we observed, and we should go back in and pull those folks out. And I don't remember exactly how many people had spina bifida, since I lumped them together in that with folks with cerebral palsy. But it's an excellent point, and noted by our study staff.
Okay.
I have a whole series of questions for Dr. Harder Johnson, but I'll just take a couple to start with. First off, is the funder QL available?
Mm-hmm.
So that's an easy question. Actually, a little bit of a quagmire right now. We're debating how to best disseminate the measure and whether we want to publish it, and in which case it would be available for sale or disseminate it freely. We may end up doing some kind of middle ground where we invite other people to do some more testing of the measure. But we're still figuring that out. It should be available soon in some way.
Okay. Would you... And I guess it seems to me that it's not function neutral, it's physical function neutral. Would you agree with that?
We were actually trying to control for function on a variety of dimensions. Physical was one of the more obvious ones, but we were also trying to control for sensory and mental health functioning as well.
What about cognitive?
I guess I'd have to look at the content of some of those questions. And I'll stop here. Do you have plans to...
Let me say a little bit more about the mental health, because we did find that particularly challenging to distinguish between a functional limitation related to mental health versus actually measuring mental health. In consultation with mental health experts, what we ended up thinking about was items where if the mental health condition was adequately controlled with the treatment, there would be no bias. So it's kind of an accommodation similar to assistive devices for people with physical disabilities.
Okay. Just relationship of the funder QL to Promise or Neuroqol, and I'd be intrigued if your panels would just go through the items in Promise and Neuroqol and identify the biased items. I think that some of the subscales perform pretty well and still stand up, and others wouldn't.
Yeah, I think that's probably true. We have not looked at those particular item banks. We have looked at the SF-36 and have a paper published on that in Archives of Physical Medicine and Rehabilitation. Would love to look at other measures. Unfortunately, our funding for this has now ended, so we're hopeful that we might be able to get some additional funding to continue more research.
Yes, it all went from Illinois Chicago. So I guess one question for Catherine and one question for Willie. So Catherine, clearly, you measure the same subject four times using different measure. So clearly, the independent sample assumption of ANOVA actually is violated. So have you tried or think about maybe using more advanced statistical modeling to analyze your data?
Thank you for bringing that up. That didn't come up in our discussions in the team. And so I will bring that back to the team, because we do have this under review right now in a journal, and so obviously want to use the most appropriate techniques. And I'll bring that up with our statisticians collaboratively.
Okay. And Willie, this one is for you. So, yeah, I think it's been brought up already. There's two major NIH projects going on right now, is PROMISE and Toolbox. So, and I know within the NIH, actually, their physical domain, they break down into a couple, like a fatigue and physical function. And for the mental health, they actually break down into the anxiety and the depression. And of course, in your tool, you kind of lump them together. Have you ever looked into their work and see how they relate to in the people with disability in this country?
We have looked at it a little bit, but not in detail, so that's something we would hope to look at more.
And actually, the second question is, I don't see much about the external validity present in your presentation. So do you have any like external validity? Most of your presentation is psychometric, of course, but did you perform any external validity for this scale?
External validity in terms of more objective measures of health, or?
Does your measurement correlate well with other existing so-called HRQOL instrument, even in this people with disability population?
Yeah, we're starting to look at that. that it correlates well in some regards where other HRQOL measures, to the extent that other HRQOL measures are measuring health in the sense that we were thinking of it, where they have function items, that's where the correlation was lower, which is exactly what we were looking for.
Any other? Oh.
Yes. Louis Catrano with the National Center for Medical Rehabilitation Research at NIH. I had a question, I guess, for the testing instrument, and also a question for Jim, for Dr. Ripper. The first is, I noticed you used expert panels in the construction of the items and so forth. Did you use focus groups to actually look at the items? And you use the term adults, and I guess my question is, what is the age range that your scale basically is useful for?
We did not use focus groups, and the age range is 18 and up.
Okay, and if I might add just one more, in terms of the IRT portion that you had mentioned there, you showed some items and you indicated the difficulty of the item. But you didn't show, for example, a domain in the distribution in a particular range so that you could say, for example, you could use it in an IRT sense. And I'm assuming that these were all paper subtests that you were using?
They were. And something that we'd love to develop in the future is a computer-adapted version where people could answer fewer items based on how they respond to the earlier items. Yes, you want to say more of the...
I think I think Willie mentioned that they looked at the range. Those difficulties are because they're a rating scale, they don't have as wide a range as individual items might have, but they looked at that and we tried to balance that across the scales so they had enough range. It's hard to have it real dense and fill in every gap in a short scale.
The other question deals with the obesity issue in terms of disability and so forth. And I'm wondering, because a number of presentations, and I think that's true, that there is an issue about obesity, both in a non-disabled population and in a disabled population. The question that I had was, do we know a little bit more about the factors that contribute to that relative to either medications that people are on or nutrition, or is that something that we need to look at closer?
Yeah, the guy with the microphone should answer that.
Yeah.
The guy with the microphone should answer that question. The guy with the microphone. Do you have a microphone?
Yes, I do.
I can't answer. That's too hard for me. No, seriously, the gentleman holding the microphone, Lou, is Kiyoshi Amake, and we just got funded, thank you, Niger, for an obesity disability rehabilitation research project, and we got one major project looking at multiple data sets, including two longitudinal data sets, and one of the research questions is, what are the antecedents and risk factors associated with obesity in youth with physical disabilities? So, we're going to be looking at that question. We're also going to be looking at consequences of obesity. And the nice thing is, Ed, I don't know if you want to add to this. Ed Wong is also the co-PI on that first project. Ed, can you raise your hand, please? Don't try to hide. Raise your hand. Yeah. So Ed's the biostatistician on the project. Kiyoshi's an epidemiologist. We've got tons of data. And the beauty of it is there are two databases that are longitudinal. So we've got BMI across time. So I think we're going to be able to get at this with this, this new diagram. It was nice that NIDA funded, because NIH can fund that kind of stuff. No, only kidding, Luke. Only kidding. Okay, good follow-up, Luke?
Actually, I got a question for Jim. We know for the BRSS, it's all self-reported. So in order to say it's false negative or false positive, you have to assume which question is the correct answer. So they might answer they have some type of physical or mental situation, but then they later might answer they have limited in certain function. But it's really hard to know which really the correct answer, right? Because they are all self-reported. So how do you determine it really is a false positive or it really is a false negative. And that matters.
We wouldn't have, our sample was people with Social Security determined disabilities. There's absolutely no question that they have a disability because they would not be receiving federal disability benefits if they did. We don't have any false positives because we didn't screen anybody without a disability. But we know we have false negatives among this group with a federally determined disability. Whether they self-report the type of disability they have really is secondary to the fact that we know they have a disability because they're in a disability program.
This is Louis Vitrano again. Just one other comment. Yesterday, which was interesting, I was in a panel, listening to a panel late in the day, and the issue about genetics came up, and it was kind of mentioned as potentially, you know, a nasty factor that might be that people with disabilities might be concerned about. But I'm wondering, in your study, for example, that may lead a clue to either how medications are being processed or potentially to this area of obesity. So I don't know if it's included or not, but.
Yeah, our study that Jim just mentioned is using the secondary analysis of the existing data. And obviously, we are limited by what kind of information we are included in the, each data set. Specific to the medication, I have to look into each of the data set, but I'm not sure if anybody, any data, national data or population-based data has the kind of questions. The longitudinal study, longitudinal database, Jim mentioned is the MEPS, Medical Expenditure Panel Survey, and also the adolescent health, which I think is funded by NIH. So we are identifying these data sets and going to look each of the data sets, what kind of variables there in relation to the actual body measurement, as well as the antecedent and consequence, potential antecedents and consequences of disability. So, we will get back to you probably to idea from that point we know which data has what kind of information more specifically.
If I just play it that the one of the nicest databases we have is the Shriners database, and you know the Shriners has a great network and work with a tremendous researcher. I should give him kudos as well along with Ed. Dr. Larry Vogel, who's a spinal cord injury pediatrician, Larry's a fantastic guy. So we got into the Shriners network now, we've got a commitment. Is it by five Shriners that are committed to giving us their data across time of youth's addresses? We've got, we're hoping to do some GIS geocoded so we can see, you know, the concentric circles associated with obesity changes, you know. Is it the parental care? You know, we know that there's some literature on overfeeding, energy expenditures lower, certain weight gain medications. I mean, there are just a whole cocktail of factors associated with this. But I have to say, since we're in a public health meeting, that it's a tremendously important public health question that we need to answer, because if a child has a disability and goes to the doctor, what does the doctor tell that parent in terms of his or her weight when the child's falling under the 80th percentile? Well, he's going to say, you know, he's okay. If they get a weight measure at all, a lot of times it's just, you know, they don't measure him because they don't have a scale, so they just say, you know, when was the last time he had his weight measured, or how tall is he? So there's a pervasive level of inaccuracy. And yet, in the early research that we just published, we just put two papers out this year, high number of secondary conditions in youth with obesity who are disabled versus youth who are disabled and are not obese. But again, it's all self-report. We don't even know if the measure that we're using of the parent providing the measure of the child is accurate. So it's a mess, really.
I just spilled water, I'm sorry. I'm going to just answer that also. First of all, I wanted to apologize. I had an error on my slide and I went back to my paper that I was pulling my presentation from. We did one-way repeated measures, ANOVA, so we should address that issue of independence, I believe. But what we've actually also collected some DEXA data on a sample of 41, 42 individuals, a subsample of one who I was reporting on today. We're seeing strikingly similar findings in terms of body composition and even normal weight ranges, and we hope to be publishing that in the coming months. And I think that in answer to the original question that Lou posed, I don't believe we know much about, at this point, what the what is causing it, although people have hypothesized or just put forth that people are just moving less, and so their energy expenditure is a lot lower. But clearly, we really don't know, and we definitely don't know what the contribution of medications, and particularly medications that promote weight gain for individuals. We do collect, we have collected medication data in our sample, and just in a quick glance, just anecdotally, a lot of folks are on anti-anxiety and antidepressants, which I understand are weight gain as a side effect on many of those.
Other questions? Comments?
I'm interested in the dimensionality of the 100 QL, and it wasn't clear to me whether the IRT was done across all of the items or four IRTs across the subscales.
It was within the subscales.
So, and I guess a follow-up question to that, it would be, you said you did confirmatory factor analysis on 1, 2, 3, and 4 dimensions. It's obvious what the how you would put the items into four dimensions for a confirmatory factor analysis. How did you put the items into a 2 and a 3 dimension?
I'm gonna have to defer to our data analyst on that one.
Yeah, you're probably aware in confirmatory factor analysis, you have to compare between models to really look at the fit. So for a 1, you just throw in all of the scales. Actually, there, what you need to do is have at least 2 measures for each dimension. So we did like split scales, split half scales. And so you just throw everything in for 1 factor, and then you just split them into 2. Kind of randomly for 2 factors and so forth. And so then you.
There was no conceptualization to base the 2 and 3 factor on.
I don't believe so. You got me there.
There was no exploratory factor analysis to see what dimensions would emerge.
Well, there is a little further. You know, I need to correct myself. The social and then the beliefs part, those 2 factors are more highly correlated than the others. So at some point, we put those 2 together.
So that put those 2 together to get the 3.
Yeah.
And then what did you put together to get the 2?
Sorry, I don't recall that. I'll look it up for you.
Well, sort of in that similar vein, did you try a second order confirmatory factor analysis to see if there was a latent dimension that was predicting the other 4 subscales?
You know what? We really need to do a hierarchical analysis, but the factors we used oblique factor analysis and exploratory, and they're highly correlated. So yes, there's an overall dimension, and that's why we can have a total score as well as the separate scores. The reason for the separate scaling of the IRT is that if you're really going to report these subscales for physical and mental and such, they really need to be tight together enough. But then the justification for the overall score is that they're so intercorrelated that, you know, it justifies the total score as well. So anyway, I don't know, maybe we need some more funding to do a fancier analyses.
Other questions or comments? Well, thank you very much. I think it was a wonderful panel.